Welcome to the Philippe Matthews Show at thepmshow.tv. Named the Oprah of the Internet by Mark Victor Hansen, Philippe Matthews doesn't ask questions that are different. He simply asks questions that make a difference. The Philippe Matthews Show features entertainers, bestsellers, authors, thought leaders, change agents, and world-class experts in the field of personal, spiritual, and professional development. An internet marketing entrepreneur, Philippe is the creator of the How Movement, dedicated to teaching people how to move from the mindset of hope to the process of how. If you are ready to take your life to the next level, move from the mindset of why to the mindset of why not. Tune in right now to this latest edition of the Philippe Matthews Show and watch your life grow.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, with another exciting edition of the Philippe Matthews Show. And as you all know, I have a propensity to enjoy surrounding myself with brilliant minds. And we don't fall short today because today we have a good friend by the name of Dr. Brian King, who is known as the Road Psychologist. I had the privilege of meeting Dr. King a few months ago when he was conducting a workshop on habits. It was an eight-hour, almost an eight-hour. It was a full day, let's say that, of nothing but how to break habits, how the brain forms habits, and it was fascinating, so much so that I begged him and pleaded with him to be on the show today. How are you, Doc?
I'm good, Philippe. Thanks for having me. Thank you. I appreciate that. You are too kind and generous with the praise there. Although the word brilliant, I think you should keep that. I like that. but definitely, please feel free to call me Brian. I've never been that comfortable with Dr. King, to be honest with you. It's kind of been taken, really.
I kind of think so. Yeah, especially around certain times of the year, say like February, I think people are real sensitive to the whole thing.
It's February. In February, I don't even like calling myself doctor.
Well, obviously you have a great sense of humor, and a lot of people don't know this, that not only are you a brilliant psychologist, but you're also a brilliant stand-up comic.
It's funny, the two careers, they kind of go hand in hand, I will say.
How ironic, exactly.
It really is. I do travel the country delivering seminars, as you mentioned. I am, and I call myself a road psychologist. That's sort of a self-proclaimed title there, but it seems very fitting. I used to call myself a stand-up psychologist, but then sometimes I like to sit down, so a road psychologist feels a little bit better.
Well, let's go back in time a little bit and talk about where did this comedic genius come from, what was that story? And then, of course, where did the propensity for psychology come from? And why did you decide to go into psychology and stand up? Where did this begin?
Well, let's say, I can't really pinpoint a beginning, but I will say that I've always. Humor is a defense mechanism. It's Freudian, of course, would tell you that.
Sure.
And for whatever reason, and I don't remember, I didn't have a bad childhood. My childhood was fine. But for whatever reason, I developed a sense of humor instead of developing, some other skills. Like other kids were playing basketball or football to impress people, I would make jokes, And so that was the thing that was the skill that I developed from a very early age. But related to the sense of humor is an ability to identify and observe characteristics about human behavior and sort of comment on them. And so there's an element of psychology inherent in being a good stand-up comedian. We have to be able to recognize, the various behavioral quirks that people engage in order to make fun of them. And so there's a degree of overlap, I guess, in the skill set there. Now, I developed my sense of humor from a very early age, and I you know, worked on that, or I became like a class clown and some, you know, throughout my education. But I didn't actually start to pursue comedy as a means of I don't know, livelihood. And I have a hard time saying that without laughing, because it doesn't really provide that much money. But I didn't start pursuing that until much later in life, and I actually started to think that, you know, I really wanted to do stand up comedy. Always having the sense of humor, for whatever reason, I've always had the interest to become a stand up comic, but I became a psychologist first, let's put it that way. And I guess the same things that motivated me to get in, to develop my sense of humor, also motivated me, or at least motivated my interest in psychology. That is the understanding of human behavior, being mm-hmm. able to observe and appreciate what I observe, being able to predict it, and just being able to better understand why people do the things that they do. That mm-hmm. really drove a lot of interest. And there's a practical side too. My other interests that I had lots of, you know, my interests are not limited to just psychology and comedy, but my other interests that I had, far less lucrative, far fewer job opportunities post graduation. So my steering into psychology as a form of training had a lot to do with evaluating, well, am I going to make more money as an artist or as a psychologist? So a real practical decision drove me into that field for study.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating, because we also share similar interests in that I know you like hip-hop, you like vodka martinis and girls that wear skirts, particularly
like
in the wintertime. Yeah, I love those things.
That's amazing. Who knew that those would be such common activities? Now, I enjoy a good martini, that's for sure. And, of course, I love the hip-hop music. You know, with those kids today and their crazy music and their hairstyles and their baggy jeans. Loved all that.
I love it.
I'm originally from New York, I always had sort of more of an urban sensibility to myself, you know. In fact, when I was in graduate school, or not actually postgraduate school, when I first got my doctorate, a lot of my friends had nicknamed me, just a little casual nickname, Dr. Ghetto. It was sort of a nickname that drew from my love of all things kind of urban, and yet, you know, the fact that I was just this walking contradiction, you know, as an educated person that throws the street slang, you know. I had my pants, I'm actually right now, my pants are below my ankles, if you know, and that's just fun.
Well, you know, here's the thing, it's like, what a culture shock. You've been pretty much everywhere in the country, and coming from New York, you now live in San Francisco. I mean, that's enough material right there.
Oh, I love it. San Francisco is my favorite city by far. It is just fantastic. I mean, don't, you know, if any New Yorkers are going to listen to this, I'm just kidding, of course. I don't mean that. New York, we all know who's the best. You know, but no, San Francisco's fantastic, and I love it. And the thing is, it's just every bit as historical and multicultural and interesting as New York City. It's just a little smaller, and it's got better weather. And so I think that, you know, it is really, to me, like the West Coast New York. You know,
I totally agree with that.
Yeah, I do get a lot of enjoyment living there. That said, I haven't been there in a while. As you know, I've been on tour, and I was in San Francisco early this year. I have since been all over the United States. I'm currently calling you. I'm actually in New Jersey, outside of New York City.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And another leg of my tour. So haven't been back home in about 3 months, and I'm starting to miss it. So hopefully it'll still be there in good shape when I get back.
I'm sure it will. Well, you know, like I said earlier when I was introducing you, I first came to know you by this workshop that you did on habits and how the brain forms habits and everything in between. And the research that was done by Dr. Noro Valco you took that research and just illuminated it and made it so plain and so real that it caused me midstream in the workshop to ask you about you know, how does the, you know, the habits and behavior, how does that affect certain populations and environments? And we're going to get into that later on. But just for the sake of understanding, what is your definition of a habit?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I don't know if I have a unique definition here. I think it's a relatively agreed-upon definition in psychology, is that a habit is just an automatic response. It's a, you know, I think in common usage, we use the term habit to describe, to use it to describe a lot of things. But from a psychologist, from our point of view, a habit is just a response that's been automated. And we, and by automated, I mean that it's a response that our brain can engage without using our conscious mind, without having any conscious input.
Mm-hmm.
Habits can be behavioral, and there are lots of behavioral habits. You know, just you know, you start biting your nails without thinking about it. You know, that's sort of a habit, right? You know, the you know, and, you know, there are plenty of behavioral habits. But a habit can also be an emotional response. You know, somebody says something that provokes an anger reaction in us. That's, that anger reaction is actually a habit. It's something. It's a response that we've learned to do without consciously thinking about it. We also can have physiological responses that can be habituated, and even cognitive habits. I actually have a couple of stories that I tell that involve cognitive habits, but. Basically what a cognitive habit is a thought that just sort of pops into our head without, you know, that we don't really have any conscious control over.
Mm-hmm.
We just kind of have those thoughts that happen. So when we use the term habit, we're really talking about a wide variety of human experiences and phenomena. You know, just pretty much any response that a human being is capable of engaging, if it's under the right circumstances, can be habituated, can be learned, and can be turned into a habit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the work from Dr. Norris Valcro was on, I guess, new brain research as it relates to drug addiction. So could you explain the correlation between habit and addiction?
Sure, sure. Well, I'd like to say that from her research now, we have this, and by we, I mean psychologists, not necessarily me and you, Philippe, but we have, although I include you, you know, I include us, you know, there's no reason to exclude us in this discussion, but psychologists for a very long time have been aware of the changes that take place in the brain when we experience you know, pleasurable events, or when we experience things that we might call rewarding. I'm using the word reward here, but it's more accurate to use the term reinforcement. But right now, I just use the word rewarding is fine. But we have there are different chemicals in the brain that are released during the experience of something we might call rewarding, and one of those chemicals was dopamine. And so, for the longest time, psychologists believed that dopamine was a chemical associated with and important to the experience of pleasure. Nora Valkov and her work has shown that we actually don't see the dopamine release during the experience of pleasure, but rather in the anticipation of that potential reward. So actually sort of turns our view of this system pretty upside down in the past 10 years. For a very long time, you know, we had had a pretty strong relationship between the experience of dopamine and the association with the experience of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's been rethought. And so, the reason why it's been rethought, the reason why it's important, is because for the longest time, we had been, and by we, I mean just psychologists now, sorry, Philippe, but
okay.
we have been bringing subjects in the laboratories and exposing them to reward opportunities that they weren't expecting, right? So Rick's putting into a laboratory, monitor their brain activity, and give them a piece of cake or some music to listen to or some other unexpected reward. And we saw that dopamine surge, and we thought that dopamine surge indicated that they were experiencing pleasure. Well, what was really happening is that their brain was experiencing an unexpected reward, and that dopamine surge was a means to help trigger learning. They need to learn. What we do when we experience something that's unexpected, we learn from our environment and learn how to repeat that response. So if I engage in a behavior that leads to an unexpected reward, I want to be able to repeat that in the future, and so I'm motivated to do so. And that's what that dopamine release actually represents. Because when we look at rewards that we expect, when we look at an expected reward, we see the release of dopamine during the anticipation. If I witness the cues, for example, of a particular reward, I see, and I used the example in my seminar, you may remember this, I talked about donuts.
Of course.
I love donuts, and there's a particular brand of donut out there that I really enjoy. I don't know if you mind if I mention it, but
absolutely, go for it. I love it too.
Krispy Kreme donuts are fantastic, and the story that I use involves when I see the sign that says Krispy Kreme. Because I've learned the relationship between that sign and the donuts that I will then purchase. When I see the sign for Krispy Kreme, I see there's a huge spike in dopamine activity in my brain. And I will go in, I will get those donuts, and if the reward that I receive matches my expectation, then there's no further dopamine activity required.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Norrish has shown us that when we expect the reward, we see the dopamine surge during anticipation, not in the actual consumption of the rewarding event. Now, how does this relate to the addiction stuff? Well, drugs, addictive substances, as I mentioned, addictive substances all have a unique characteristic to them, and that is that they all increase dopamine activity in some way or another. They increase the activity of this chemical, right? So when we experience a drug reward, say for example, we take heroin or meth or whatever. When we experience a drug reward, we see that surge of dopamine. We see that surge of dopamine in the anticipation of that rewarding event. The problem is that the anticipation, we get the dopamine from the anticipation, but because of the pharmacological effects of the drug, because the drug increases dopamine activity, we see additional dopamine activity after we consume the drug. And that additional dopamine activity is essentially tricking our brain into thinking it got a bigger reward than we anticipated. And as a result, then, the next time we encounter the opportunity to use that drug, we estimate, a greater potential reward from that experience, and we again are tricking our brain into thinking it got more reward than it did, and so on. So every time we end up using a drug, the next time we're going to value that response even higher and be more motivated to engage in the response.
So this is fantastic information because most people have a thought that people who are addicted to substance abuse are bad people or people that have no self-control. When in actuality, I mean, we're looking at, talking about just the late and great Whitney Houston. This was a function of her brain that she did not know how to turn off and how to control.
Exactly. Now, I don't want to say it's completely outside the realm of self-control because we do have, control, especially in the early stages. We choose to engage that response. But after a while, after we allow the system to take place, eventually the behavior becomes something that really doesn't look very voluntary. Because of this process of the drug increasing dopamine activity and tricking our brain, constantly tricking our brain, to increase the reward, the potential benefit that we expect from that response, we ultimately end up engaging in behavior that's not very voluntary at all. So it might start out as a choice, It might, you know, it might start out as you know, behavior that we have some control over, but when it develops into something we call an addiction, it really is a behavior that we have very little control over. We have a very difficult time kicking out of that particular cycle of behavior.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I remember hearing interviews, one with Natalie Cole and one with Elle LaBarge, who just recently had a relapse, and both of them in their interviews said that the first time, and this, of course, is different for different people, but the first time that they made the choice to try cocaine, they knew right then and there that they were going to have a problem, but they couldn't stop it because the release was just, and then there are others who I know who have tried it and they got sick and it was a horrible experience and they never did it again. So this really is a neurobiological throw of the dice, in a sense. Would you agree with that?
I would. There are things that could predict our propensity, but I would say that it's kind of just we don't, from an individual point of view, we're not going to know how susceptible we are until we try it. There are individual differences in our ability to perceive rewards. I myself, I'm glad this is radio, Philippe, because if you people were looking at me, they would see I'm a pretty big guy. And, you know,
not as big as me,
radio. This is radio. I can tell all your listeners that I'm a nice, lean, buff, 6'2". You know, I'm a very attractive man. No problem. But the fact is, no, I am overweight. And I experience a lot of reward value from food. I'm someone, you know, I don't know if it's you know, my taste buds are a little bit more sensitive, or if areas of my brain are a little bit more responsive to that food reward. But there are a lot of people out there who don't get the same reward value from food. There are a lot of people who, you know, who are less motivated to eat, or it doesn't provide them with as much perceived benefit. There's individual differences in our ability to experience rewards. Some people will take a hit of marijuana and think it's the best thing ever. Some people will take that same drug and, you know, be not very interested. So the mechanisms behind our individual differences to experience reward are going to vary depending on the substance. You know, and they're going to vary. There's a lot of things going on there. So to some level, that's hard to predict. It's hard to predict who's going to really love, you know, an awesome steak, and who's mm-hmm. just going to be like, whatever, I'll just get a hamburger, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure. It's fascinating that it's, you know, that dynamic, that volatile.
Yep. But I will say this, there are conditions that are predictive of a greater potential for engaging in that type of behavior. This probably doesn't have much relevance to Whitney, as she was a superstar and very wealthy and a celebrity. I believe she was, to be honest, I don't know when her drug use started, but I believe she started using drugs after fame. We do know that when we're depleted or restricted of opportunities for reward in our environment, that creates a condition we call dopamine deficiency. And when we have dopamine deficiency, in very brief terms, drives us to engage in behavior where it drives us to seek out highly rewarding experiences. And so whatever that reward might be, so a dopamine deficient individual who has some experience with a food reward might develop a disorder of compulsive overeating, become obese. A dopamine deficient person who has some experience with a drug reward might develop a drug problem, et cetera. So there is a genetic predisposition to this dopamine deficiency in the form of, there's a gene that, you know, promotes it. So that's one possible avenue that might be predictive of who's going to be more susceptible to develop a compulsive disorder over another person.
Well, you know, funny, I'm sorry, go ahead, Doc.
No, please.
When we're talking about the dopamine deficiency, stress is a trigger, would you agree, to seek reward? And when we're looking at someone like, say, you know, superstar or of Whitney Houston. Success at that level is stressful.
Stress is an interesting concept because stress, the effect that stress has on our habits, really, is that stress makes us more likely to engage in our bad habits. Specifically, not necessarily our bad habits, but our habits that provide us with the most benefit. And very often it's our bad habits that provide us with that benefit. You know, the overeating, the drinking, the drug use, etc. Those are very rewarding behaviors that we engage in. And so when we're under stress, we prioritize anything that provides us with an extreme amount of reward. The reason for that is because our habits, essentially, from a very basic point of view, I'm using very simplistic language to describe them, our habits are responses that we've learned that make life better, right? That's the whole reason we've learned them. Because in the past, when we've engaged that response, it made life better for us. And so we want to do that response again. That brings you back to the concept of reinforcement. Reinforcement is when life is better. So a habit is just a response that makes life better. Well, being stressed to put it in very simple terms, is an extreme need to make life better. When we're under stress, our body thinks that we're under attack. Our body thinks that we're in some form of danger, and that presents a very extreme need for us to sort of make life better, to use the same terminology. Mm-hmm. And for both, any behavior that we previously have experience with that provided us with that sufficient amount of benefit. So when we're under stress, like when I'm under stress, I'm going to grab a candy bar. You know, when someone else is under stress, they might grab a drink. You know, they might grab a bottle. Someone else is under stress, they might reach for, you know, the vial of crack. Stress promotes the usage of any of our habits that have previously provided us with some form of significant benefit.
Now, you're bringing up a really great point here and offering some great insight because what you just said, you know, some people go for the candy bar, for the drink, or for the drug because we are seeking stress-relieving activities. It is also part of or influenced by our environment that we're in at the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would say that.
So for instance, I'll give an example. So, you know, the kid or the young adult who was born and raised in poverty, that environment will cause them to create stress. Not knowing when your next meal is coming from, not knowing if you're going to get shot or killed, that's going to trigger stress. But also, let's say that kid grows up and becomes, you know, world-renowned, famous, whatever, very successful and financially empowered, there is a level of stress that comes with then maintaining that. But
yep.
It's the same brain trigger.
Absolutely. And I'd like to say poverty is going to have a lot of consequences on our habit expression. Not only is there stress, and the stress associated with poverty is definitely a contributor. We see, and you know, I don't know if everyone listening is going to be familiar with this, but all the disorders that involve overusing our habits, things like, you know, overeating, overdrinking, you know, alcoholism, drug abuse, all those types of disorders are all much more prevalent in people that come from an impoverished background versus a more affluent background. Definitely rich people, you know, develop those disorders too, but they develop them at a much smaller percentage. You know, as a percentage of the affluent population, fewer of them develop these types of disorders. These disorders are much more prevalent in people from impoverished backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that
mm-hmm.
is the stress. Poverty, as you mentioned, it creates a condition of stress. And, of course, as I talked about, stress promotes the use of our bad habits. So, you could develop a habit of eating excessive chocolate cake or smoking excessive amounts of marijuana or whatever, but at any socioeconomic status, But if you are from the lower form levels of socioeconomic status, you're going to be more likely to engage that behavior more often, and as a result of that more frequent engagement of the behavior, more likely for that behavior to turn into a disorder. There is one other contributor here, and I started to go into this when I was talking about Whitney Houston, but then I switched gears midstream.
Mm-hmm.
But I was talking about reward deficiency. Reward deficiency, or as I talked about earlier, dopamine deficiency. Reward deficiency is a state of mind that we enter into when there's a lack of opportunities to make our life better. As I mentioned, habits are ways to make our life better. And essentially, poverty is an extreme lack of opportunities. Affluence, on the other hand, is an abundance of opportunities. So we have both the stress of the poverty environment and the lack of reward opportunities. Both of those things combined promote the usage of those behaviors and result in a greater prevalence of developing those types of disorders.
Wow, that's incredible. So where does the psychosis of learned helplessness come into this language or come into this conversation?
Well, learned helplessness is actually comes from animal models of stress. We only do these types of research in animals because it would be completely unethical to stress a human being to the point of learned helplessness. There's no institutional review board that would allow such research to occur. Despite what movies might tell you, we do have ethics. But learned helplessness is a condition where if we continuously stress an animal. And I don't want to make it sound like psychologists are doing this all the time. We did it so that we can learn it, and we're not sitting around just playing with animals and trying to do bad things to them. That's not what psychologists are about.
Mm-hmm.
But if we continuously stress an animal and they have no relief from that stress, nothing they do will help to alleviate that stressful condition. They will eventually stop trying. They will stop trying to change their environment. They'll stop trying to relieve their stress. And we call that learned helplessness because they have learned through the process of stress exposure that nothing they do will change their situation. So they stop trying. That's learned helplessness is also a model of human depression. It's basically what happens when people become depressed. They stop trying to change their situation.
This is amazing because obviously we see this prevalent in impoverished communities, people who come from gang-infested environments, unsafe environments, even bad relationships, domestic violence. All of those are stressors that trigger and can trigger the learned helplessness.
Actually, and depression is also one of those disorders that I mentioned earlier. Well, I bet it's much more prevalent in impoverished communities or impoverished people from impoverished backgrounds.
Now there was, and I'm looking for it here in my notes. There is what I loved about that workshop that you offered is that there you also talked about certain parts of the brain that. The dopamine and the reward centers, where these areas are triggered. There was one that struck me in particular, which was called the prefrontal cortex, or the the VMPFC. There's a part of the brain where after a certain amount of stress that occurs, it begins to weaken, and all of a sudden you just stop, or it stops creating strategies to better your life or to get yourself out of a situation. Is that correct?
Kind of. It's a basically what you're referring to is our ability to activate an area in our brain, and you are at the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, but when we activate that part of our brain, it turns off our stress response. Now, the activation of that area of the brain is it's a conscious mechanism, so there's a subjective experience to it. Activation of that part of the brain is associated with a strong sense of control. So if we have a strong sense that we are in control of our lives, then what that essentially allows us to do is eliminate the effects of stress from our lives. When we have a well-developed sense of control, when we have a strong sense of control, we basically activate this circuitry that allows us to shut off our stress response.
Mm.
And we relieve ourselves from all the effects of stress.
So another term that you used in the workshop then was called secondary gain. How does that play a part?
The secondary gain is an interesting concept. Secondary gain is, as I mentioned previously, there are lots of things that are rewarding to us. We threw out some examples there. I like food reward. I like, there are other people who like alcohol. Whitney, of course, had her rewards that she found in her environment. But there are lots of things out there that have an intrinsic reward value to them, that things that we don't have to learn to be rewarded by. Very often we will experience that reward, and for something in our environment will provide us with a secondary or bonus reward. Example I like to use is that, eating for me has a great reward. Eating for most people is a very rewarding experience. If you eat in the company of other people, that feeling of acceptance, that conformity, that the enjoyment, the social interactions that we experience, that's a form of secondary gain. And that makes the eating behavior much more likely to be repeated. Because what we've now done is I've taken behavior that has a normal reward value to it, and I've made it a lot more rewarding by receiving this additional gain, this additional secondary gain.
Oh, this is amazing. This is how gang act, why kids will go into a gang and because you're socially accepted. And so that becomes a secondary gain for them and so on and so forth. And then there goes the life.
Not only for for gang acceptance, but also just for the drug use, for everything that we've talked about so far.
Sure.
These secondary gain, of course, is something that would help motivate continued use of these particular substances, these habits, or these sources of rewards.
So here's what I want to do, because I know your time is limited. I want to have you come back on the show, and
okay.
Let's talk more about this and talk about some solutions and how the brain can overwrite the code of learned helplessness and stress, and how we can begin to retrain our brain. But before I let you go, let the people know how they can get in contact with you. What is your web address?
Sure. It's funny. My internet address is primarily focused for my comedy work, and it is Dr. Brian King, all one word, .com. So that's DrBrianKing.com. What I find intriguing is that as I've been traveling as the so-called road psychologist that we've been talking about, most of the traffic coming to my website is from people looking for information on psychology and on habit training and habit formation. So I think I may actually have to put some of that on my website. Right now my website is just really focused on my comedic material. But if you want to see me do a few jokes or a funny rap song, go ahead and check out drbrianking.com. If you're interested in following up with this material or any others, you can also contact me through my website as well.
Fantastic. Well, we're definitely going to have you come back. I appreciate you so much for taking time out of your road psychology schedule, because you're literally sitting by the side of the road talking to me right now.
I'm literally sitting in my car somewhere in New Jersey, pulled over to the side of the road.
with your pants hanging down by your legs, too. Don't forget that.
They keep falling. As soon as we hang up, I'm going to be bumping the Wu-Tang all the way back.
All right, my brother from another mother.
That's right.
I totally appreciate you. I so thank you for your graciousness. Let's have you come back and let's continue this conversation because it's absolutely fascinating, our human brain and breaking it down and understanding how it works. So with that, thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Philippe. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
You got it, my friend. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.